back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. As we enter into this hour's discussion, looking at what's been going on in California, both with the Black Lives Matter activist Jasmine Richards, who has been sentenced to prison for felony lynching, and we'll talk about that, and the conviction of a young man named Brock Turner for rape. Convicted on three counts of felony sexual assault and was only given 6 months in prison, while a young African-American man, Cody Beatty, was convicted of the same thing not long ago and given 15 to 25 years in prison. So we'll talk about all that and the nature of sexual assault in America. But first, I want to remind you on the way there that these kind of discussions are only made possible because of support from institutions like MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Let me introduce our panel. Kalima Young, instructor at Towson University and University of Maryland College Park, where she is getting her PhD in American Studies. Has been guest on the show for many years, on and off, and co-hosts our program and hosts our program and does more. Good to have you here in the studio, Kalima.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Dr. Desiree Melton joins us once again. She's Associate Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the APA Site Visit Program at the School of Arts and Sciences at Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
Okay, you always get which one's which. Notre Dame of Maryland University. Good to have you here, Desiree. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to have me.
And Brittany Oliver, welcome back. Women's rights activist and co-director of Hollaback Baltimore. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email us to talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page and leave your comments, 410-319-8888. There's so many places to begin. These two things that seem to me deserving of a conversation. The first, let me just start, they're both in California, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
But when we saw Jasmine Richards, who is one of the founders of the Pasadena, California Black Lives Matters movement, and Judge Elaine Yu sentenced her to 90 days in jail, 18 days served, 3 years on probation, 1 year of anger management, because they intervened in an arrest and were charged with felony lynching.
Mm-hmm.
First thing I thought, and I looked it up, and felony lynching, of course, was in California, was a law that was brought into effect actually because of the lynching of two white men by a mob in Southern California back in the 30s, but also stands in the back of the years and years of people trying to attempt to have a federal anti-lynching law passed that never got passed in the United States Congress ever in the 20th century. And here we have now a young black woman who is standing up for the rights of our community and battling racism, being jailed for intervening by standing between a police officer and an arrestee with this felony lynching charge. It was just ludicrous and overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts? At least that was my – I didn't mean to put out my whole position there, but that's my thoughts. Kalima, go ahead.
Oh, golly, I don't even know where to start, Mark. I had to look up what felony lynching was. How often do we understand lynching laws in the first place, or much of the history around the anti-lynching campaigns and what they're designed to do? But the simple, just metaphorical idea of a black woman being charged with lynching, it blows my mind, and it seems to set – it's one of these precedents that it seems to set one of these it makes me fear for an ongoing dismantling of radical activism, that she is being used as a scapegoat to begin and the continued attempt to neuter the Black Lives Matter movement, to neuter, curtail radical interventions in police brutality. And it scares the life out of me. That's just my honest 100% initial opinion when I first read about this case and saw information about it.
And from what I understand, there have been several other people who have been charged with lynching over the years, black people. But their charges were dropped. She's the only one who was actually prosecuted. And like Kalima, I'm horrified and terrified. And I think I think that we have to wonder if the reason, if she's being made an example, mm-hmm. because she's a woman, because she's lesbian, mm-hmm. she's radical.
She is, that's an important point, too.
Exactly.
I think that
may have something to do with it, that she is held up as an example of what black women cannot do, mm-hmm. but it's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to raise the issue of her being a lesbian a little bit later because it was clear to me she was, and then mm-hmm. of course we knew more that she was, and what that mm-hmm. says about how many women in this movement who are leaders in this movement, not all of them, but many of the women in this movement who are leaders are lesbians, mm-hmm. and what that says. But I'm going to come back to that point. I think it's really important, according to this way.
Yeah, so I second everything that was said, you know, so far. But one thing that is very clear to me is that this is not an isolated incident. This is Black Lives Matter activists have been targeted and for their activism and for what the movement stands behind. This is happening all across the country. Here in Baltimore, during the Baltimore uprising, activists here were targeted. So to me, it's one piece to a larger puzzle of structural and institution sanctioned violence, where this is happening more and more.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things some people around the nation have portrayed this as the first Black Lives Matter person to go to prison, which is not true.
Which isn't true.
Because we have all the people here in Baltimore, as you were just describing, Brittany, who, like Bullock and others, who were prosecuted and imprisoned for their participation in what happened in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Folks, do join us at 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation. We want to hear your thoughts on all this. I think that, I mean, you know, they always say that California leads the way. Right?
The people's hope not.
People's park.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, right. And I think that is what this might say about what you were saying. I think you said, Kalima, you both reiterated it, was the dismantling of the radical activist movement.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of assault on this. Because clearly, I mean, if you saw the video, they were having a demonstration about the killing of a young man who was killed by the police, by the Pasadena police.
Mm-hmm.
Saw this woman in an altercation with a business owner and the police arriving, and they came to protect this woman.
Right.
Not attacking the police, really, but came to protect this woman.
Yeah. No, this is clearly a political prosecution. The first one ever convicted, African-American woman convicted of a lynching. This is obviously a political moment. It is an opportunity. I feel like it's just an opportunity to work really hard to dismantle activism, to instill fear about interrupting in state-sanctioned police violence and police brutality, that people are not supposed to put their lives on the line in that particular way or they're going to be convicted and sent to jail. I don't know.
I mean, what do you think? What were you about to say, Desiree?
I'm just in agreement with her.
You have this look on your face like...
That's just my face.
No. I'm kind of horror and shock at this. I mean, just... where this going on and what this might portend for the future of the growing movement in America and what, you know, what the dynamic we're setting up here in this country now. I was thinking about a piece John Nichols wrote in the Nation magazine yesterday where he attacked Speaker Ryan, who said that the comment that Trump made Ryan seen the comment Trump made was textbook racism, and then went on to say, "But you know, I'm still supporting Trump."
Mm.
Right? And to me, you might think those things are connected, but for me, it is where they are connected. I think that because it's not taken seriously, people do not take seriously enough, nor really understand that depth of racism and what it means and how that plays out in situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes something that sometimes it seems to only be. I don't know, Hollaback came to my head, not because it's the name of your organization, but it's like the Hollaback seems to sometimes reverberate inside of a room bouncing off the walls with the same people hearing it without people outside the walls understanding the depth of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like a Greek chorus. Everyone's just repeating these things, but where actually is it going? Because that incident, to me, is that difference between people understanding racism as something that's structural and institutional versus referring to racism as prejudiced, right? And this weird, this lack of understanding of racism as a structural and institutional construct. So I can be prejudiced against you because you are a white person, but that doesn't mean that I have no power to back that up with legislation and state sanctioned, you know, power. But people don't understand that. So Paul Ryan can say, yes, this is textbook racism, talking about prejudice.
Right, exactly.
But he's not actually teasing out actual structural racism, which is the entire American government. So in my humble opinion, you know, and I think that's where the breakdown happens.
Yeah, and I agree. A lot of people don't make that distinction between institutional structural racism and individual racists. Mm-hmm. But even if Ryan does not understand the difference, and he just might not, he is still saying that it's okay for this racist to be president of the U.S.
Right.
Right.
So regardless of whether he's going to make a distinction between the structural racism, he is still saying that I'm going to back this racist mm-hmm. to run for the office of presidency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Please.
I'm not sure if we are also discussing the Stanford case.
We are going to, yes, absolutely.
Are we going to, okay, should I wait for that or?
You can.
Okay.
We're open. Go right on.
Okay. So, you know, when I think about, when I think about what's happening, because a lot, in California, It all of this is reminding me, talking about Donald Trump, and all of this is reminding me of how important local politics is. Because there are, again, when I mentioned the Baltimore uprising, there are the same situations, it's the same incidents that are happening right here in our city, in our state. And so the Stanford case, for example, is just, again, what I mentioned. I mean, is it all? It's all in very unfortunate situations. But all of this is a prime example of theatrics, political theatrics, which is a distraction from what is happening right here. Online and on television, I saw the outrage that people had with the mugshot of
Brock Turner.
People are really outraged by the fact that his mugshot didn't come out, it didn't look a certain way, and people are giving more concern to that than actually getting justice for the woman that was assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things are theatrics to me when we're talking about Donald Trump, when we're talking about those things, because weird face. I'm a woman. I'm a black woman in Baltimore who care a lot about gender, who care and advocate on behalf of gender-based violence. And when I see these theatrics in the media, I think about what my position is and how much power and how much influence that I have to make a difference in my own community. Because I don't have control over what's going on. And me versus the government institutions. One of my mentors, Reverend Heber Brown, said to me, "Individuals are no match against systems and institutions." So when I think about myself and I think about what's going on over in California and Black Lives Matter, and in Black Lives Matter in other states as well, local politics is very key. It also reminds me of when we're talking about resources, funding, power. Where power, not charity. Where are resources going at to women in our communities who are doing work around preventative work around gender-based violence? Where are those women? Who are reporters going to them? Are we uplifting their stories? Do we have access to the funding, all this funding that's going around the state? Who is it going to? I think that these are really, really important questions that we need to start asking ourselves. So all the national stuff, everything that's on Facebook right now is reminding me, a grim reminder of the work that needs to be done in our communities right here in Baltimore.
So, and I think that is important, and I think that we can't lose sight of that, and it has to be part of this conversation. I think that one of the things that I do want to touch on, and we can talk about how that affects the community we're in, is the fact you have what happened, what you mentioned, what happened in California. I was just really flabbergasted when I wasn't aware of any of this until this Brock Turner thing, until until the conviction, and then his only being given 6 months because the judge said this would just hurt him and there's no reason to do this to him, and it was just 20 minutes of his life and
20 minutes of action.
Of action. Thank you very much, Cleo. Mm-hmm. 20 minutes of action, which also kind of was a despicable way of describing what he did. How he would never have been caught had these two other young men not ridden by on their bicycles and felt something was amiss and then tackled him and held him until the police came. But it was just so glaring to me that you have this young, white, upper-middle-class kid mm-hmm. accused of rape.
Athlete.
Mm-hmm. And then you juxtapose that against young Black men and of color who can have been convicted of the same thing and getting 4 years, 10 years, 25 years in prison, mm-hmm. and he gets this slap on the wrist, and will get out probably within a month and a half with good time, and more. So I mean, this was just so blatant, and the power of local is how you control that locally, you know. And when you read the, and maybe if a chance, we'll play some of the woman's statement, because the woman's statement just really. Just whenever I hear that, it's really this deeply affects me. Anytime this is sexual assault, it deeply affects me. But this has deeply affected me.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to talk about local politics and what we're doing at the local level against sexual violence and gender-based violence. But I do think that it's also important to recognize that the way that this has been presented nationally is important. I think it's important that there actually was not a mugshot used initially of Brock. There was this picture of him. I'm not sure if it was a yearbook picture. I'm not sure what it was, but he was in a suit. He was in a tie. You know, his blue eyes and blonde hair was played up for maximum effect.
Uh-huh.
But we know that if it were a Black man, they would have used his mugshot. And I think that's important because they want us to think about Brock Turner in a certain way. There's a reason why he's described as all-American. Mm-hmm. Olympic swimmer, or you know, someone who was accomplished enough a swimmer to go to the Olympics. So I think that's important to talk about, and I'm happy that people did call the media out for that, and mm-hmm. that we did eventually see his mugshot.
Right,
and that was because of pressure.
Right,
exactly.
So I think we should do both. I think we should call the media out for how they're representing him, but also focus on the violence and the rape culture that brought this about.
Right. It's a part of we have to unpack narratives, especially narratives around sexual assault and sexual violence, because there are multiple narratives that are being placed that this story is indicative of. There are layers of privilege as it relates to white privilege. There are layers of whose sentimental story of victimization gets to be held up and said as this is the story of what rape actually looks like. Her statement, the survivor's statement, tore my heart apart when I read it
Me
Sunday.
Too.
Tore my heart apart, especially coming from an event I'd been doing some localized work around sexual assault for like 3 days with a group of awesome activists. So I'm reading this statement Sunday and you hear the strength of it. And she's explicit about this is my lived experience in this. And she's calling him out face to face. And still, as graphic and clear and painful as her narrative is, it still invisibilizes the way that these narratives play out for other women and different types of women. So there are all of these layers of narrative that have to be unpacked in this Stanford situation, that this provides us an opportunity as people think about this stuff. People are doing work on the local level. People are trying to explode how we think about rape culture. It provides us many different avenues to do so.
Well, I don't know anything about this woman. Nobody's seen a picture of her.
Nor do I.
I don't know if she's white, if she's Latina, if she's Black.
But we do know that she is educated.
Right. I mean,
she wrote an articulate letter.
Right.
And it resonated with a lot of people, but she doesn't speak for every rape victim.
What does
she doesn't
mean?
Represent every rape victim.
Speaking for and not representing are two different things.
I think it's both. I think both. Well, she certainly doesn't represent every other rape victim. Like what I think Kalima's saying is that there's a class layer here as well. I mean, a woman who cannot articulate it the way that she did would not be heard. It would not be read on CNN. It would not be published. It would not resonate with people the way that hers did.
I mean,
so we may not know her race, but we do know that she is educated.
So let's explore that for a minute. That to me is interesting. And I'd get all of our thoughts on this. And then we open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Donna, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call. And I get your thoughts on this. What is that noise?
Yeah.
410-319-8888 is the number here. We're getting attacked from outer space.
It's the government.
You brought them.
I did it. Too much X-Files.
But, I mean, sometimes it does take, given the nature of this society, somebody who can articulate a pain in a way that expresses the pain that thousands and millions of others have felt.
Truth.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, so I'm just saying that when you say it doesn't represent everyone, mm-hmm. but maybe in some ways it does. Maybe she said something that I think there are millions of women who feel and have felt in this country as victims of that kind of sexual assault in America. I mean, sometimes it takes that.
I think it takes a statement like that to motivate people and make people understand the graphic nature of sexual violence, as it referred to her. The fact that the idea of I speak for all women as a black woman, that causes me pause. As a black queer woman, that gives me a little bit of pause. Because I'm like, hold on, we cannot necessarily embody all. I speak to a large number of victims of sexual violence. Okay. Because there are men who have that experience as well. There are trans folks who have that experience as well. There are women on the border. There are men on the border. It completely invisibilizes childhood sexual abuse, like the many different ways that sexual violence plays out. So it's one of the reasons why both Brittany and I don't know about you, but both Brittany and I are heavily involved in the project, you know, Force and the Monument Quilt. The idea that we would be that the stories of the multiple ways that sexual violence and sexual assault occurs, we're creating an opportunity for many different stories, not just one, to be uplifted and in the ether so that we can see how sexual violence plays out across class, across race, across orientation. And, you know, by trying to get 6,000 quilt squares of sexual assault survivors, get that quilt together and blanket the entire National Mall in 2 years so that we can start rewriting the narratives that we set up and hear about what sexual violence actually means and who the victims are. So her statement, 100% powerful, and I'm happy that she did it and I'm proud of her. And mm-hmm. when it's like, you're not alone, I'm like, no, you are not alone. We are right. all standing with you. And we're also standing with the millions of other folks who are experiencing sexual violence and sexual assault in many, many different ways and those stories that need to be uplifted as well. I think right. that's also, it's not an yeah. either or.
Right, but it just really quickly, it just reminds me of the well-known old criticism about the feminist movements where white women's, you know, spoke for women of color. Sure. I mean, there's some overlap in our concerns, but they don't represent, the white women did not represent all women in the feminist movement. Likewise, she does not represent all rape victims for the reasons that Kalima described. It doesn't make her statement any less powerful.
Nope.
It doesn't make her victimization, doesn't diminish her victimization at all.
Nope.
But I just think it's important to recognize that there's privilege in who gets hurt and who does not.
Right. No, I think that always is the case in society.
Yeah.
I mean, it always is the case in society.
Yeah. So you see the privilege being played out with her and you see the privilege being played out with Brock, and it's an interesting treatise.
And it's played out in the media and the representations, right? Using the mugshot, using the prom picture, the describing the missing girl as beautiful honor student, and then the other woman, you know, we don't care about her. The black girl who's been missing. I mean, it's a part of the same big issue. There's just layers of privilege, and I think if we focus on one, we're going to miss the others. We need to look at all of it.
We have to take a short break here. Brittany, you want to take us a break with a thought?
Sure. I was going to just briefly just, you know, there are a lot of Brocks running and walking around.
Mm-hmm. I went to school with them.
Mm-hmm. I know.
We all did.
There are a lot of them walking around, right? And so when we're thinking about who in, you know, who the media tends to talk about the most when you're talking about gender-based violence, you know, I'm thinking about all the women that I know in the community here, right here in Baltimore. Mathina James Brightful of Heal a Woman, Heal a Nation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Shauna Mary Brown, Heal a Sister.
Mm-hmm.
Marissa Stone Bass, The Living Well.
Mm-hmm.
Alexis Flanagan from Hope Works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to start shifting power, not charity, to women who are doing preventative work, so that we can all, you know, get rid of, so that we can continue to doing work, but also so that we can prevent stories like Brock from happening. Because the truth of the matter is, there is more that he's that same person. What he did, there are a lot of Brocks walking around right now. What are we going to do right here in our communities after we have this discussion? What are we going to do next?
Well, let's talk about that when we come back from this break, and how these two kind of cases represent something very deep in the society. That's why they're connected in the show today. 410-319-8888. Tracy and Donna, we're going to come right back and come right to your calls as soon as we return from this brief break. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. This is Mark Stanner. Good to have you with us. We are here connecting these stories about the man who got off, this young white man who got off for raping a woman after the jury convicted him of 3 counts of felony sexual assault, and what happened to Jasmine Richards, who was convicted, Black Lives Matter woman who was black, queer woman who was a leader of the Black Lives Matter movement in Pasadena, who was convicted of felony lynching, the first African-American convicted of felony lynching in the history of the United States, felony lynching. 410-319-8888. As you talk with Kaleem Young, Dr. Desiree Melton, and Brittany Oliver, and you, 410-319-8888. And Tracy, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Just wanted to say, first of all, I love your show.
Thank you.
Your voice. I love how you bring taboo topics to the table unapologetically. I wanted to say that I love the fact that that lady's letter is being read and is getting so much attention, not because she's a white lady, not because she has privilege, but because sexual abuse and sexual violence and rape culture is such a taboo topic that sometimes it takes a voice, a privileged voice, for the attention to be made. 6 months for murdering and violating somebody's innocence is a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why so many victims who have been victimized, who are now survivors, find it difficult to break their silence. There are way too many stories that are untold, way too many stories that are hushed, way too many stories that are never even get a 6-month violation. He's not the only rapist that's only received 6 months or a slap on the wrist or mm-hmm. hardly anything. That same culture happens to black people.
Mm-hmm.
I am a part of an organization where we deal with sexual violence and sexual abuse, and we take it from a standpoint of empowerment. These people murdered our innocence. They murdered who we were. They murdered who we had the potential to be. But in that murdering, they created somebody else. And we rise from the ashes. There are so many organizations. Your last person just spoke about the many champions of courage in our community here in Baltimore who are of color, who speak on a consistent basis, who have been breaking their silence to talk about this pandemic that's happening in all religions, all cultures, all demographics, all age groups. I just champion that lady for speaking her voice because she's not alone. We're not alone. And this topic needs to be discussed. And if it took her letter being railroaded all across the country and all across the world for this topic to no longer be considered taboo, then I applaud her and I thank her. In 6 months, whether they showed his prom picture, his glorious picture, or his mugshot, he looked sinister in his prom picture and his high school yearbook picture. He looks sinister in his mugshot. 6 months is a joke, and he didn't just get it because he's privileged. He got it because rape culture is still considered, oh, it wasn't that serious. You survived.
Oh, sure.
Tracy, thanks for that. It's very powerful. I appreciate you speaking up. What is the name of your organization, by the way?
Well, the organization that we founded is called Phoenix Rise in Baltimore. However, there are other organizations that are working just as powerfully. LaQuisha Hall, she works with Queendom Tea. Angela Horton, she has Phoenix Ministries, and we have support groups. She has support groups out of the Empowerment Temple. Mathina James Brightful with Turnaround. There are so many amazing organizations in this city that are doing champion work, that if you need help and you want support and you're ready to break your silence, even if that means coming in a room where you say nothing but you see and realize that you're not alone, there are organizations that are around this city. You're not alone. The Quilt Project was magical here when it happened in Baltimore, but it was painfully beautiful to see so many people who were willing to be brave enough to put their story on a piece of quilt to be attached to other pieces of quilt, where the quilt was so humongous that it took up blocks of the city. But that's a painful, beautiful thing, because these topics won't be taboo anymore. But when we hold our stories in and we're afraid to tell, and we're too concerned about what other people have to say, then it just makes the next generation susceptible to having a first style. It makes them susceptible to needing to write a space on a quilt that will be shared around the world. We want to stop having quilts needing to be made. So I applaud her for being brave enough to stand up and say something, because so many of us wait too long to say something, and by the time we do break our silence, we realize that our silence created an opportunity for more silence to be had.
Tracy, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thoughts from our panel?
Amen and Ashe, and amen and Ashe.
And same here, Ashe.
I thought about this. I was going to read this, but we're going to play a tape of it. It's just so weird if I read it, because it's a man's voice, and I think it should be a woman's voice.
I don't know.
Huh?
I don't know. We are all a part of rape culture.
We are. And, you know, and I think that I personally think that misogyny and rape culture runs really deep.
Mm-hmm.
In human society. I think it affects Jasmine Richards' sentencing and why she was put away.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
Right? As
yes.
an outspoken black woman.
Reminds me of Out Into the Night, the group of, you know, the lesbian gang, terror gang in New York,
right.
who were defending themselves against a man and ended up having to go to jail, right?
Right.
Sorry.
No. Why are you sorry?
Yeah, it's just I feel like you were in the middle of saying something and I got all incensed about it.
No, you're right. No, that's just your show. I'm just trying to get things fueled up. Because I think that and I think it does run so deep and it has through human culture, period, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we just don't understand the profound nature of it. I think most people I think women do more than men,
mm-hmm.
But we don't. I mean, there's almost every woman in my family has been affected by this on one level or another.
Yep.
And, you know, and you when you're a man and you sit among other men and you hear the way my brothers joke about women, I mean, there's one thing to joke because people always joke sexually about one another, and that's just the nature of humankind. Women do it, men do it, we all do it. Mm-hmm. Gay, straight do it, lesbian, we all do it. But then it can go from that to something that is the culture that breeds
exactly
that it's okay to take what you want, to knock off a piece if you want that piece.
Right.
And that's the part we have to really unearth and say, no, it's not acceptable. No, we can't talk like this. Mm-hmm. No, we can't let our little boys think like this. I mean, that to me is how deep this runs and affects both cases I think we're talking about. I'm sorry, Brittany. Did I cut you off? You were about to say something.
No, I was going to just say personally, I think that it is, you know, it is very important for men to be a part of these conversations. It is very important for men to, you know, learn and take action and help us with trying to fight against rape culture, gender-based violence. You know, men and boys go through this too.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go through it. We all deal with it at different levels. It all is based off on your, you know, race, class, gender, sexuality. It's all, there's so many layers. And I always encourage men to be, you know, to be a part of the conversation.
They have to be.
You have to be.
Yeah.
You have to be. It is over a period of time of doing work that I do, you know, with Hollaback. We focus mainly on anti-street harassment. And then we connect anti-street harassment to, you know, gender violence and broader issues. But I have always encouraged men to be a part of the conversation. Just come and talk to me. Let's just talk, you know?
Yeah. I was teaching a policy and activism class a few years ago. I had about 17 students, bit of an equal split between men and women, and one or two gender fluid young people. And I put out the statement. I was just like, all right, so how many of you have experienced or been impacted by sexual violence, right? And how many women in here have been, you know, mm-hmm. and every single woman in my class raised their hand. And then I asked my male students, how many of you know someone who has committed an act of sexual violence or sexual assault?
What they do.
None of them raised their hands.
Interesting.
And I was like, look around you. So who else are these people that are doing these things then? And then I started breaking down what consent meant in all of these different ways that we can talk about sexual violence and gender-based violence. And slowly hands started raising up. Well, my cousin did this, or we had this conversation. I didn't stop my homie from doing this. And men are just as much a part of this dialogue, just like
they have to be,
right? The way people are like, well, it's not just Black people who have to deal with racism, prejudice and racism. White people are getting impacted by this jazz too, right? Same thing around sexual violence. We are all colluding. We're all participating in this this painful generational tango, you know?
A dear friend of mine who was a freedom fighter, white man who served time, came and spoke to Notre Dame. You know, it's he spoke to the day students, the day programmers, it's women's college. And he spoke to them and he gave a really powerful talk talking about his experience as a freedom fighter. And some other white students asked, so what, you know, what can we do? You know, what can we do? And he said, well, white people need to talk to white people. It can't just be Black people talking to Black people about racism, because we already know. And it can't just be Black people teaching white people about it. White people need to talk to white people. Well, same thing here. Men need to talk to other men about it. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but we all know that that Brock Turner's father wrote a letter, right? We talked about it. It's just 20 minutes of action. You know, his 20 years of life, why are you doing this to him? He shouldn't have to serve this much time. I believe his name is John Pavlovitz. I might have that name wrong. But he wrote a letter in response, a father of a son speaking to a father of a son, and he broke it down in a really powerful way. And all the ways that we were just talking, that men need to talk to other men and tell them that it's not acceptable. We don't want to hear about your son not being able to eat his favorite food and your son is depressed and it's not the issue. Your son victimized this woman. And it was, I suggest you look it up.
I will look that up. I'm going to open the phones here again, and I will read two of the things that she said, because that really struck me. The statement that she turned in, she said, I stood there examining my body beneath the stream of water and decided I don't want my body anymore. I was terrified of it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what had been in it. If it had been contaminated, who had touched it, I wanted to take off my body like a jacket and leave it at the hospital with everything else. And that morning, all that I was told was that I had been found behind a dumpster, potentially penetrated by a stranger, and that I should get retested for HIV because results don't always show up immediately. But for now, I should go home and get back to my normal life. Imagine stepping back into that world with only that information. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything she said in this statement was like,
yeah.
To me, it's so profound, and when I read the other stat, and then we'll open the phone to you. I read the stat. I think I read it to you all 4-1 in the air that really blew my mind this morning. Not that I was shocked by it, and I say it still blew my mind. Out of an article around this case, it said few reports of sexual assault ever lead to prosecution, and this is from a Department of Justice report. Let alone prison time. Between 8 and 37% of rapes result in prosecution, according to this one study from the Department of Justice. And a national estimate from there suggests that for every 100 rapes, only 5 rapists go to prison. Those are really profoundly alarming statistics.
Unbelievably. Not surprising.
Right.
But still alarming.
410-319-8888. Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Mark?
Right.
Again, always good topics. T.D. Jakes, one of the well-known evangelical preachers, he had a program for men, and he asked something that shocked everybody. He asked all the men who were sexually assaulted as children into adulthood to stand up, and pretty much the majority of the men stood up.
Mm-hmm.
And what I heard was, it was so overwhelming that he was trying to teach these black men that sexual assault is wrong, whether you do it to others or it happens to you. And I think that was a powerful thing that he did, because he opened the eyes to other men who didn't believe sexual assault happened. He let other men who this did not happen to see that it happened to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
My point is, when we go to the courts, and this is something I've talked to my own lawyer about, these judges, whether they're appointed by a Democratic president or Republican, they turn the tides around when these cases come to them, any discrimination cases, whether it's employment, whether it's gender, rape, whatever. Their personal biases get in the way of reality when they listen to these cases. And that's why that movie Spotlight came out, because trying to get the Catholic Church to admit that this happens, it's just fight. And until we embrace, it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat, Republican, conservative, or liberal, sexual assault, sexual abuse, whatever, from childhood to adult is wrong. And if we don't take a stand from the family to the churches into the courts, this is going to continue. And my question to the young ladies is, how can we, or are you, or any groups working to change policy at the congressional level? Because these judges are causing more harm when these cases come up. And that includes men who are raped as well. Because when men are raped, that's even worse. Oh, how can you be a man and get raped? That's unheard of. So they stay silent. Our women are staying silent. And we have to now start smacking these judges and saying enough is enough. And I wanted your guests to talk about that, and I have to listen. Thanks, Mark, again.
Thank you, Donna. Any thoughts for our listener?
Wow. So isn't the Violence Against Women's Act about to be up for reauthorization again? It was reauthorized back in 2013, and in that time, that's when they also added the provisions about tribal jurisdiction. Am I correct, Brittany? Do you remember from our presentation that Alexis did?
Yeah, I think it was, it's not coming to me right now, but
yeah, so you have the Violence Against Women's Act, which is always up for reauthorization every few years. There are a number of policies. There are some federal coalitions that have been created that are working to implement the Violence Against Women's Act and expand it. But one of the things I think is really important, just speaking to your caller, and it sort of goes back to Brittany's discussion about local politics, is actually understanding. You know, we have to sit there and we have to vote on judges, right? I don't know how many of you guys actually really sit down and read the results, right? And read what these judges do and the work and what they're, how they've been judging on things.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're thinking about this from a local level, this is where local politics really comes into play. Who are the people that we are electing?
Mm-hmm.
How have these judges been making decisions? How often are we actually criticizing and critiquing how policies are being implemented in schools, at prisons, and different institutions?
Mm-hmm.
This is where we actually have local power to address it, is to understand our local politics and who's running what and how people have been voting and setting precedent. So I would suggest to the callers to really keep on encouraging an intense scrutiny of the judges and the local politics that are happening in our city and in our state in order to affect change around these issues. I don't know if other folks want to add to that.
We've got a few minutes left here before we have to turn over to our next closing segment on the city paper this Wednesday. So these are some quick closing thoughts from everybody here about what these two cases and these two situations tell us.
There's a lot, Mark. We covered a lot of ground.
We did. Well, that's okay.
Still not enough time to cover
no.
it all.
No, it's not. No. So, I mean, I think that it needs to be something we continue really bringing up in some really deep ways and bringing people on here who can help us wrestle with this and we should be wrestling with outside of the people who might be on the same page about how to wrestle with all this.
Right. All I know is I've spent the last few days really trying to do a lot of soul-searching work around my own activism and then also combating and working and trying to help reframe a lot of people who I feel are rape apologists that are out there in the world. And I think if there's something that we can continue doing those moments and helping people to understand how they are colluding with rape culture, misogyny, and apologizing for rape,
okay, we get the word then we'll break. Go ahead.
Really quick, can I just read a little snippet from what this father wrote to Brock's father? If his life has been deeply altered, it is because he has horribly altered another human being because he made a reprehensible choice to take advantage of someone for his own pleasure. This young woman will be dealing with this for far longer than the embarrassingly short 6 months your son is being penalized. She will endure the unthinkable trauma of his 20 minutes of action for the duration of her lifetime, and the fact that you seem unaware of this fact is exactly why we have a problem.
30 seconds.
So
I guess Madam starts running this one through the glass.
Yeah, so, you know, this we're not able to cover everything, and you know, this can be a much longer conversation, but what I do know from doing the work that I've been doing with a number of activists, including Kalima, is just that gender-based violence, rape and sexual assault, these are issues, especially when it comes to my community, in the Black community. We need to have deeper conversations about how systems are currently in place that are impacting our ability to be able to come together to solving them. And that is what my focus is now, to addressing the issues on a local level. So I would encourage everyone, just get involved with us and let's come together so that we can end this in Baltimore and beyond.
I want to thank all of you for being here. It's a great conversation. Good to have three of you in the studio here all at once. This is wonderful. Brittany Oliver, women's rights activist, co-director of Hollaback Baltimore, Dr. Desiree Melton, associate professor of philosophy and associate director of the APA site visit program at the School of Arts and Sciences at Notre Dame of Maryland University. Good to have you here, Desiree. Good to see you again. Good to
thank
have you in the studio.
Good to see you.
And Kalima Young, instructor at Towson University, University of Maryland College Park, co-host and guest on this program. In our weekly segment, we're looking at many things in our culture, and good to have you back always here on Wednesdays.
Oh, thank you very much, Mark.
Take a short break and find out what's happening in the city paper. Stay with us.